Welcome to the March 2016 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The March issue is on the topic of utility of intraoperative imaging. In this podcast, we hear a conversation between topic editor Dr. Rudolf Fallbusch of the International Neuroscience Institute in Hanover, Germany, and Dr. Alexandra Golby of Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. They discuss Dr. Golby and colleagues' article, Optical Technologies for Intraoperative Neurosurgical Guidance, which appears in this month's issue.
First of all, to introduce myself, Rudolf Fallbusch. I'm Emeritus Director and Professor of Neurosurgical Department, University of Erlangen. And since 10 years, I'm in the International Neuroscience Institute in Hanover, the Director for Endocrine Neurosurgery and Intraoperative MRI. So shortly, you, Dr. Golby?
I am Alex Golby. I'm a neurosurgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. I'm also the director of the Advanced Multimodality Image-Guided OR at the Brigham, which is a laboratory for the development of new intraoperative techniques.
Great. And you are part of the interdisciplinary group, which plays also a role as authors, and with you, I think, is also Dr. Pablo Valdes. Tell me, which part does he play in this interdisciplinary group?
Dr. Valdes is one of our residents, and so he's in training, but he has a PhD in optical imaging, and so he is actually working with me to develop our optical imaging approaches.
Great. So without these specialists, also maybe biophysicists and computer scientists and so on, this will not work. May we,
absolutely,
to introduce our approaches to intraoperative imaging. So I myself, and I would like to include some historical aspect, started with ultrasound in the early 80s when we wanted to find deep-seated lesions from CT, and later on we performed laser Doppler fluorometry in 91, followed 93 by stealth navigation, and 96, a little later than you in Boston, with a low-field intraoperative MRI. So what is your approach to this field, and why are you performing optical imaging?
So our approach, like you, is multifaceted, and we have used many different methods over the years to try to improve the accuracy of the surgical gesture. And I would say we're actually relative newcomers to the optical fields. We have developed now a series of research technologies which we're using to try to define the critical aspects of the tumor in real time. So for us, we are interested in defining the tumor margin and also in defining some of the qualitative aspects of the tumor. And we have an approach right now where we're using Raman spectroscopy. As you know, in the United States, we don't have 5-ALA available under FDA guidance.
Yes.
And we are using this in conjunction and together with our intraoperative cross-sectional imaging. So we have both intraoperative ultrasound and high-field intraoperative MRI. And we feel that that gives us an opportunity to correlate the findings from one method compared to other methods.
That brings us to the question that we should try to define the position of intraoperative optical imaging among the others, which you have said already. So may I ask you, when do you use intraoperative MRI, and is there still a place of awake surgery in your practice?
So we use intraoperative MRI for those cases where we think that it will be difficult to visually determine the boundary during surgery, and in particular for low-grade gliomas. We also bring this together with our preoperative mapping, which is a big part of our program, where we use functional MRI and diffusion tensor imaging to define the critical regions of the tumor. So one does not preclude the other. It's certainly possible to use the preoperative non-invasive mapping to help guide and refine the deployment of intraoperative mapping to make it more expeditious and perhaps easier to interpret sometimes equivocal findings. In my own practice, I find that I am moving away from awake surgery because I'm gaining a lot of trust in the non-invasive preoperative functional maps, and I find that it's easier for the patient and easier for the surgeon if we can do as little awake mapping as possible. So I would say I use it selectively. In our setting, it's quite challenging to get an intraoperative MRI with the patient awake. It does introduce some concerns about airway protection.
So that's great to hear, because when I came to the International Neuroscience Institute, Professor Zami did a lot of awake surgery, and with gaining confidence in the functions and the mapping and so on, and the DTI has given it also up. I think since some years we never have done awake surgery. Maybe there can be exceptions in the future. Let us start with the functional mapping. So functional mapping, you said already you've done it before surgery, but there's also a place for optical imaging with a wide field microscope reflecting imaging. Have you heard about it, or are you experienced with that? What, for example, Gabriele Schackert is doing in Dresden with a contralateral stimulation and see then the bold effect on the brain?
So we are aware of some of these techniques, including, as you say, the imaging the bold effect or the vascular effect, imaging also the intrinsic signal of the brain. We actually have some colleagues doing some basic work on using ultrasound elastography to look at the different functional activations in the brain. But we have not used that. My feeling personally is that if one is going to be interrogating the function of the brain in real time during surgery, then using electrophysiologic measures, which are better understood, probably makes the most sense. And if real-time feedback is critically important to guide the resection, then I do think that there's no substitute for an awake patient.
So we have also experience with that, and it's also limited mainly to the sensory cortex, less important, I think, for language. And it could be a way, but maybe in the beginning. Let's switch over to the extent of resection. And although you have a very elegant structure of the text, you are dividing the text in two parts, I think, with exogenous markers as fluorescence and intrinsic optic signals without exogenous agents. But you have given five examples from your own experience. So one is ALA protoporphyrin.
It is experience of Dr. Valdez when he was at Dartmouth.
Yeah, and then the fluorescent sodium, and then finally the intraoperative spectroscopy, the dual probe for fluorescence and reflectance, and then Raman spectroscope. So my question is, if you can tell me when we are using the ALA or the fluorescent sodium, and when are you using the Raman spectroscopy probe?
Well, I'd say at this point, these are really tools in development, and we are in the sort of early stages of the translation of the technology into the operating room. So I would be more able to sort of think about how we might envision the use of different techniques, because obviously these techniques differ in many variables, making them more suitable for use in some situations than in others. And I think one of the important questions for surgeons who are tackling these problems as we go forward is to try to come up with some best practices. So, for example, I think one of the real benefits of optical imaging is that it creates a signal which is visual, and surgeons are used to looking with their eyes at the surgical bed. And so any signal that is visual in nature is intuitively easy to understand. And so I think that working on techniques that provide a macroscopic identification is very important. In another direction would be looking more at quantitative imaging. So being able to have algorithms of classification which would allow the surgeon to get a binary answer, yes or no, are also directions that we're looking in, and quite different from a visual, more analog result.
Will this bring us more results, that we see more hidden tumor which we cannot see with our eyes, or better into the borderline?
Well, I think that it depends right now on which technique is being used. There are some techniques that appear to be less sensitive for detecting tumor and others which appear to be more sensitive, and
mm-hmm.
similarly with specificity. So
mm-hmm.
that's why, as our colleagues continue to develop these techniques, we need to continuously inform them of what the clinical constraints are regarding identification of tumor. Because, as
mm-hmm.
you say, the margin is indistinct, and we will not necessarily be able to or even want to follow every last infiltrating tumor cell. And this is where, of course, the integration of better tumor definition using optical techniques does interface directly with the question of better eloquent cortex definition. Because
mm-hmm.
if we're going to start to follow into the infiltrating zone, then we will, of course, need to better understand what the functional effects are of
mm-hmm.
the tissue that's resected.
Let me ask a question about the kind of visualization. So on one end, we see colors, and on the other end, we have bands. And for the interpretation, especially for the Raman spectroscopy, I think, if we have these bands, can you interpret this by yourself, or do you need any expert who tells you what it is to come to a kind of objective adjustment?
Yes, I think this is a very interesting question. So when we do our Raman, we actually do a Raman imaging where these bands are rendered as a image that looks very much like a histologic image. So on some level, the technical complexity has been removed, and the result is an image. So that's nice, but it does then beg the question of who is going to interpret the image, because in the end, surgeons are not neuropathologists, and
yes.
also they're busy.
Yes.
And so I can envision one scenario in which pathology and surgery actually become much closer and work together side by side during
mm-hmm.
the course of the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can envision a different scenario in which machine learning and other algorithm classification schemes are developed. And I don't really know. It'll be very interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in the chemistry if you use the Raman spectroscopy and the mass spectroscopy?
Yes.
I think you have published
yes.
also the stereotactic biopsy with mass spectroscopy. And so I think there can be differences in the lipid and protein fractions in Raman and in mass spectroscopy. Are
right.
you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay.
So the mass spectroscopy is interesting because it does allow the definition of individual quantitative chemical peaks. And can do so very quickly in basically near real time. It can also produce an image, but that tends to require technology that we're not yet able to deploy in real time. So right now, on some level, one could see an integration of the two approaches, meaning that a Raman approach might be able to quickly identify an area that is representative of tumor and also an area that was representative of normal brain, and then
mm-hmm.
use those in a kind of training algorithm
mm-hmm.
that could then be applied to the mass spectrometry data.
So on one end, we can identify, tumor. On the other end, we have the chance also to identify borderline and invasive tumor areas. And now the next approach is, which is the way from this intraoperative diagnostic program to the therapeutical use, which is the workflow? Are you, when you have detected it, do you find it again by navigation? And how far go you into the field, or go you in the borderline to resect it if you have identified it?
Yes. So I think this raises some very interesting and important questions. One is, do we want to developed techniques that can be used in vivo and actually in situ? Or would we be satisfied with techniques that could work ex vivo?
Yeah, it depends on how ex vivo, how long you can wait. I think if you can have a diagnosis within 5 to 10 minutes aside of your operating field, I think it is near real time. That would be sufficient. I mean, real time is difficult. Even if you see a signal and a band, your reaction is also not real time. Real time is only when you do surgery under the operating microscope. I think it can be justified to wait for some minutes.
I think that it may be that the information can be given to the surgeon in stages. So, again, for example, as we do now, we may consult with a pathologist for some guidance, but then perhaps as the resection nears completion and the surgeon has very particular small areas which they still are uncertain, they might be able to query those areas, for example, using a touch probe that would be able to give the results much more quickly without having that 5 or 10 minute feedback loop.
Maybe we need, besides the diagnostic scanning, also a kind of robotic microscope who applies our coagulation or mechanical removal, because for the small invasive area, it will be necessary to do some more sophisticated mechanical work, which is beyond our capacity. Let us come to some other technologies. Do you see, besides what you are doing, other technologies in a sensible way, like optic coherence tomography or confocal laser scanning endoscopy?
We have certainly discussed some of these techniques, and as you know, there's some efforts to commercialize systems along these lines. My concerns have to do in part with whether the signal is strong enough to be able to use without a marker. So we're very interested in what we can do with a label-free approach as opposed to a labeling approach. Now, one could also envision that with the right markers, a labeling approach could be much more powerful. And indeed, there are some in vivo work which suggests that there might be several hundred-fold difference in signal between tumor and background signal using these types of approaches with the right kind of labeling.
What about other technologies like quantum dots? You mentioned it also shortly in your article. Maybe if they are combined with antibodies or with EGF, for example, it could have a chance for therapy.
Yes, and this work is very interesting and exciting work to, again, have this very, very many, many orders of magnitude difference in signal between the tumor and the background. I'm going to be very interested to see how these works translate into in vivo settings, because, of course, there are some concerns about the safety of the quantum dots. And then also another interesting challenge is the issue of the penetration and the ability to image at some depth.
So we have discussed, and I think the Boston way and our former Erlanger approach, and also what we see and I'm doing in Hanover, is that we try to have the utmost cytoreduction in gliomas, for example. But you know, there are a number of oncologists who have their doubts. For example, Patrick Kelly wrote when we published our papers on intraoperative MRI and so on, that we are doing Sisyphus work, so it is not very sensible. Does it help the patient really? Can we conquer the disease or not? What do you think about that? Shall we go deeper and deeper without knowing if it really helps the patient?
That, of course, is a difficult question. I think that in the last decade, there have been a good number of studies which have shown, I think, quite convincingly that there is an improvement when approaching gross total resection. And I do think that the majority of glioma surgeons now ascribe to that philosophy. What is much less clear is whether there is any additional benefit to the so-called supertotal resection or to chasing the infiltrative margin.
Yeah, that's a good term, supertotal resection. I didn't mention this before, but that's a good term. I think we are coming nearly to the end of our very interesting discussion and to a conclusion. And the volume tissue for neurosurgical was how useful is optical, intraoperative optical imaging today. So maybe you can summarize it also to combine it with a question, can it has the potential to replace the actual dominating MRI? And can we visualize something even beyond MRI?
Well, like you, I really developed a practice based around MRI, both in terms of the preoperative definition of the goal of surgery and then of the intraoperative imaging to evaluate the extent of resection and to find and remove tumor residuals. So that experience now is nearly 20 years old, and I think, of course, will not be quickly discarded. But I do think that some of these imaging based on optical properties and the basic interactions of light with the tissue itself will someday supplant MRI, because we know already that MRI underestimates the extent of the tumor. And we also know that MRI is able to really image only at the most macroscopic scale, and that the technology is extremely expensive and very workflow disruptive as well. So even in its present status, it can only be available to a small minority of neurosurgeons and hence to patients. So like you, I'm very excited about technologies that could be deployed that are both based on more intrinsic properties of the tissue itself, that are less vulnerable to brain shift and other changes that take place during surgery, such as edema or blood, and that also will be able to be controlled and held by the surgeon, either held as a probe or used through our optical systems like the operating microscope, because these are the tools really of the neurosurgeon, the tools that we all were trained to use and with which we have great comfort.
This is a good final word. I think I agree with you. I also will give up intraoperative MRI, which of course is too much cost intensive, as soon as the progress with optical imaging will become more and more convincing, and we will have also a three-dimensional visualization of the tumor and the possibility also to resect what we have seen also in the border. And again, congratulations to your review article, to all the efforts you are doing in Boston, being again among the pioneers for intraoperative imaging, and I wish you good luck for the future with your group. And I think we could answer the question about the usage of intraoperative imaging very well. I think it is useful to perform optical imaging even today, and it will have a great future. Can you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that having centers like yours where we can compare different techniques to one another, where we can remain open-minded about which is the best technique in which situation, is very important.
Alice Golbia, thank you very much, and have a great rest of the holiday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate being part of this issue.
This concludes our podcast for the March issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the April issue, when the topic will be sports injuries, diagnosis and management strategies. Thank you for listening. Follow the JNS on Twitter at #TheJNS. And please like us on Facebook at Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.